So this is Andrew McGregor from thehermitslamp.com, and this recording is a focus on why the Thoth deck is wonderful and why you should get over the fact that people tell you it is evil, why there's nothing to be afraid of here, and just how interesting it is to work with this deck. This was originally planned as a conference call. However, for a variety of reasons, that did not work out. And so this is a slightly shorter version of the talk that I was planning on giving then. So, I mean, one of the things that I hear a lot, because for me, I started working with the Thoth deck, and it was the deck that I used with clients first. It was the deck that I learned from first. I spent the better part of 20 years reading Crowley's work itself, studying the cards, working with the Thoth deck specifically, and really, really kind of delving into it to the exclusion of everything else. I didn't start with a Rider-Waite deck. Technically the first deck I owned was the Mythic Tarot, but I didn't go too far into that before discovering the Thoth deck, because when I purchased my Mythic Tarot, I also at the same time got a copy of Crowley's Magic and Theory and Practice way back when I was 13 and started digging into that. So, you know, one of the things, though, that I've heard people say is that you can't use a deck that has difficult cards in it with people. That, the Thoth deck will scare people, that the Thoth deck will make them run away. I've also heard things like, well, you know, the Thoth deck will call evil spirits and take over your soul and you'll be destroyed because of using it. I mean, after 20 plus years of working with this deck, I've never seen any evidence of any of those things. And I really think that, if you're going to work with any deck, and if you, as a reader, your choice is to work with a deck that you like over giving choice to clients, which has always been my approach, that is to not give anybody a choice, but to do what's going to help me best tap into the reading and do the work that I'm there to do, you need to give people a lot of credit. I've used the Thoth deck at parties, at corporate events, at all sorts of different things. And, you know, almost nobody has ever said anything about it. And certainly nobody has ever said anything overtly negative or been scared away by it. And when those more intense cards or when the artwork shows up that some people find disturbing, in general, I found that the people who get in those cards, they always know what's going on. They are totally aware that there is something that is a disturbance in the force of their life. So, you know, that's one of the things I think is really important to, pay attention. Let's respect the maturity and the potential depth of the clients that we're working with, and really, really trust that they can handle a kind of grown-up, full-of-life tarot deck. And this is one of the things that I truly love about the Thoth deck. The Thoth deck doesn't shy away from life. It doesn't shy away from stuff that sucks. It doesn't shy away from sexuality. It doesn't shy away from even kind of commenting on the way in which the world is messed up. You know, and we'll get to talking about Crowley and the problems with him specifically in a little bit. But, you know, when you're doing a reading for yourself and, you get a card like the Five of Swords, Defeat. You know, I mean, we can look at this card and try and rationalize it. But especially for people who are going to be reading for themselves, having a deck with clear-cut cards that say no, that say, hey, you know what, this isn't a good idea. Hey, this isn't going to work out. Hey, you're fooling yourself, you know. Hey, look at this, you know, your lofty ideals are failing here, you know. Hey, look at this, everything is turned against you and you're not going to be able to overcome these obstacles. You know, these kinds of things that are really clear-cut in a deck are really profound gifts, you know, and whereas, you know, sometimes people want to make everything all love and light and nice and, clean and deny the warts and things, the reality is that sometimes life sucks. Sometimes life is a kick in the pants. Sometimes the things that we hope for the most don't work out. And sometimes a whole bunch of things that we can't even see or understand work against us and don't allow us to overcome. You know, I mean, another card we can continue down the road to the Seven of Swords, right? You know, if we're going to stick in the same suit here for a little bit. You know, and in this card we've got Six of the Swords, all sort of ganging up on one of the swords and perhaps breaking it as well. You know, and this idea that something might be a grand good idea, like doing this telecall tonight, for instance, where I'm recording instead, but for reasons that we can't foresee, for other things to do with planning and structure, it's impossible for us to always follow through. You know, in this case, everything else didn't work very well. The technology seemed to be a bit glitchy, and a whole bunch of people decided to catch it on recording. You know, it's all fair enough. It's life, right? And one of the things that I think is really astoundingly helpful about working with a deck that has specifically negative cards, cards that are hard to relate to, or hard to accept, or we wouldn't choose to have them be the outcome for ourselves most of the time, is it encourages maturity. It encourages growth. You know, and although we could talk, there are lots of ways in which we can do that with our clients. You know, having a deck where the things are just laid out as being inherently negative is really, really helpful. Some of the other things that I think are really profoundly helpful with this deck is that it's a complete inherent structure within itself. You know, it's certainly true that, you know, Hebrew Kabbalists and, you know, even European or French school Kabbalists would disagree with Crowley and what he has done and what the Golden Dawn with their set of Kabbalistic attributions. I don't really know that it matters. You know, after studying all these things for many years and after talking to people from a variety of schools of thought, you know, the point in the conversation where one group of people is declaring that another group of people's conceptions, philosophical base and structure is just hands down incorrect, you know, those aren't conversations that I'm interested in having anymore. And the people who are really keen on having them, well, if you're interested in having them, you know, you can certainly go and look online, and there's lots of people who will talk about that. But I don't know that it matters. You know, I was talking to Yoav Ben-Dov about his Marsai deck the other day, and we were discussing the various schools of Kabbalistic thought, and he said it best. You know, he's like, just go and learn one. Just pick one. Whatever one you like, just go and learn it, and that's it. Work with it. And, you know, this is my experience with this as well. If you're interested and if you're drawn to the Thoth deck, then understanding the Kabbalah of the sort of the Western mystery schools is going to feed into that. It's going to give you a complete structure. And it's going to give you all sorts of layers that you can start to add to your tarot readings. You know, so for me, when I'm doing numerology with my cards, my numerology is wholeheartedly Kabbalistic. You know, there are certainly other schools of numerology, and they're all great. But I've never really studied them that much. And, you know, we get into stuff like master numbers and all these kinds of things. It's never been a part of my practice. I see why people like it, and I see that people get stuff out of it. But when we're looking at the Thoth deck, we can refer to the Kabbalistic numerology as being something that will give us a lot of information. You know, all the sevens will have something to do with Netzach or with Venus, right? All of the fives will have something to do with Mars, you know, and with Geburah, you know, and all of these things, they influence it. You know, when we're talking about the fives, right, we're going to be talking about stuff that has to do with force, with conflict, with difficulty, right? You know, because that martial energy, as it comes into the world, it causes challenge for people, right? And, you know, when we're talking about, whether we're talking about interpersonal conflict, or we're talking about war, or we're talking about, you know, other things, we're always going to have this sort of set of conflicts when we're talking about the fives. And so that helps us understand inherently what it is that's going on with them. When we're talking about these associations, we can also talk about them relationally. You know, if we're talking about fours versus fives, right, we can speak about the fours. We can talk about the fours as being the expansion of Hesed, you know, and this Jupiterian energy. But we can talk about the fives as being that counterpoint energy, which once again reins it in. We have these polarities between cards that fall to one side of the tree of life or another, between expansion and contraction, between working to keep everything back on balance so that everything doesn't dissipate into nothingness, and yet everything isn't just constrained back into such limits that everything sort of implodes. And we have these dialogues and dichotomies that are really super fruitful. Some of the other things that are very helpful is we can meditate on pairs of cards that belong together and we can look at them based on the Kabbalah that's associated with them. So, for instance, right, we have the fool, whose Hebrew letter is Aleph, which means the ox, right? And what's a wild ox going to do? What's a wild big animal like that going to do? It's going to go wander wherever it wants, right? In the absence of structure, that animal is going to go wander through the world, right? It has a potential to work. You know, we could try and harness the ox. We could put it to work for us, to plow our fields, to carry our burdens for us. But its natural tendency is not to want to work per se, right? It's not following its bliss or its passion. It is actually just doing what it is that it wants to do for itself, if we leave it alone, right? Now we can look for what other ox symbolism is there, right? And if we look to adjustment card, which is what Crowley calls the justice card, we have the Hebrew letter lamed, which means ox goad. And an ox goad is a stick or something else that one pokes and prods and cajoles and controls and threatens the ox with in order to make it do the work. And so here we have this dichotomy, this duality between the adjustment or justice card, that is, the card that represents the laws and rules and structure of society, influencing and working against the ox, the untamed beast, the untamed wild nature of people, the desire for people to go do what they want when they want, right? And so we have this relationship between them. And Crowley talks about it in various places, that the adjustment card or the justice card is the harlequin, which is the counterpart to the fool. And we have all sorts of dualities that attach to this, right? So we have these various pairings for Kabbalistic or other reasons that create a sense of unfolding, that allow us to look at them within a reading and say, oh, look, here we have, you know, the justice card preceding the fool card. Okay, so what is the relationship of control to freedom here? What is the relationship of individual expression versus obligation? We can delve into these various levels from a Kabbalistic point of view. And of course, depending on the person you're reading for and depending on your own practice, you may or may not refer to them overtly. You know, I don't really say to somebody, well, you know, it seems like your entire point of consciousness has withdrawn to this one-pointed Kether-like, that is to say, the top of the tree of life, point of energy and unity, and therefore it needs to unfold and expand through, you know, the Sephira and these other things. I don't really have those kinds of conversations with people, although if you get excited about Kabbalah, Western or otherwise, you'll start to think in those kinds of ways, which is pretty fun, because it allows us language and structure and relational ways to express things. The other thing behind this is, because tarot itself always is a complete set of things, but I think especially because of Crowley's attention to astrology and Crowley's attention to the Kabbalah, I find that the Thoth deck is much more coherently a system of everything in a way that other decks sometimes lack a clear sense of things, right? It's not that the progression from the fool to the world or the universe card, as it's called in this deck, is necessarily a clearly delineated line, you know, just like it is in other decks. There are questions about the order, and there are questions about why the cards might follow each other, or these kinds of things. But at the same time, they all have a place, and they all have a relationship. And whether you choose to swap a card with another, as in the great debate around whether the Emperor and the Star card should have some of their attributes switched, or their place on the Tree of Life switched, or any of these kinds of debates, they still are only switching within a certain very concrete structure. And ultimately, it's up to you to decide whether those things make sense for you or not. Personally, I don't really follow any of the switchings that go on with the Star card and the Emperor. For me, somebody once expressed it to me in a conversation I was having with them where we talked about the Star card really should be the stars. you know, and maybe in some decks it is, and this sort of plurality of it, I think is the most important thing. And if you get interested in Crowley's work, and if you're going to go and read the Book of the Law or some of his other writings, you're going to get into all of these dialogues about, you know, the line, every man and woman is a star, you know, and all this kind of discussion about that. And the notion that we are a singular expression of ourselves within a multitude of expressions of the universal self is really one of those things that I think is very important. And if we're going to talk about it, you know, I think there is a relationship between being a star, that is, attending to and understanding our true nature, and, you know, some other ideas that really feed back in to sort this out. But again, I would say, and let's talk about Crowley here, on the one hand, some of the things that Crowley talked about are utterly irrelevant. You know, the debate about whether it's this or that, whether it's one thing or another, ultimately, I'm not even sure Crowley knew. I'm sure if you asked him at one point, he would say one thing, and if you ask him at another point, he'd say something else. And in terms of hoping that it's going to come down to a concrete, definitive answer, well, his writings never do, and I doubt that his personal self ever really did either. You know, obviously he had an answer at the end of his life, but is it the answer, and does it matter? I think it's more important to ask these questions. Another thing that we touched on briefly here is the idea of astrology, you know, and the sort of clear connection between the planets within different signs, the way in which all of the signs loop around together to form a wheel of the zodiac, the way in which we can look at the court cards as expressions of part of one sign of the zodiac and another based on the way in which they line up. You know, those things really define a whole lot about us, right? And so, as a quick example, we could talk about the Queen of Wands. So the Queen of Wands covers 30 degrees of the zodiac. So she is 1/3 Pisces and 2/3 Aries. And if we know about Pisces, it governs the 12th house. That is the deep waters, the unknown, the unconscious, the collective unconscious, these things that are never really able to fully bring to light in one way or another, is at least one interpretation of that. Another interpretation, or the other half of the equation, is that Aries, this fiery go-getter, Aries is the sign of force and war and directness and boldness and brashness and all of these kinds of things. And most Aries that I know are very direct, they're very confident, they're very, very focused on what it is that they want to do and what feels important or right to them. But you combine this with this sort of slightly undermining that energy, or, you know, of the Pisces connection. And so that 1/3 Pisces eases or diminishes or undermines that strength of that Aries. And this is where we start to drift into the ways in which that card can specifically be insecure. That is, when that card comes up against something that it thinks it was confident in, especially maybe around friendships or alliances, and it realizes that something else was going on, that the story it had bought into is not exactly what's really there, then we have this massive outburst of rage and anger and this great explosion, and always because of this sort of Piscean unknown, or this uncertainty and insecurity that hides behind or underneath all of this other fire and force. And if you get excited about this deck, and if you start to work on it, you know, or if you take the class that I'm running next month, we're going to really delve into the ways in which the different signs, the different elements of astrology combine within the cards to help us understand them. And this allows us to either bring in our astrology, if we've already studied it, or to bring in our Kabbalah, if we've already got some grounding in that, as well as to branch out from tarot itself into these systems and to see them as a set of correlations. And when we're doing readings, it allows us to say, okay, so this card is Aries, and that card is Aries, and this card is Aries. There's a lot of fire and action here. It's another layer that we can add to our readings that can really give us a sense of, a sense of the interplay and the connection. We can watch the flow beyond just the level of, oh, well, there are a lot of cups, or there are a lot of this, a lot of wands, a lot of majors. Those tools are also really wonderful. But to say, oh, look at that, there's a whole lot of Aries here, and yet there's a whole lot of discs. Well, that's an interesting combination. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is very grounded and set, and yet there's a lot of this fiery energy too. These levels of information add more and more subtlety and more finesse to our reading process. So, and I mean, I think the thing I want to finally touch on here is a lot of people don't like Crowley. And to be honest, I'm glad I never met the man. I don't think that I could tolerate to hang out with him. His arrogance, his sexism, his controlling nature, you know, these things are not really how I like to relate to people. The challenge in deciphering Crowley, though, goes to a few things. First of all, there's no point in trying to deny that he was anything other than what he was, which was a product of Victorian times. And although he put a lot of emphasis on liberation for everybody, his capacity to perceive and see what liberation might be was always limited by his times and just how much he was able to shake those off. You know, the other side of it is that he also had all sorts of problems, you know, with drug addiction and other things that, you know, there's really no excusing them. There's really no making sense of them per se. But at the same time, as I grow in my life, and as I look at the lives of the people who I've studied with and teachers, very few of them are free of flaws. And in fact, many of the teachers that I've had the privilege to spend time with and receive guidance from, you know, they had pretty huge flaws that they were in one way or unable to get beyond. And so, I mean, each person has to answer for themselves whether we expect perfection of our teachers or not, whether we expect them to still be human or not, and whether or not, as I think that people can be, someone can be astounding in one area of their life and be a right mess in some other area of their life. And, you know, this is a challenge, right? Obviously around his sexism and his misogyny, it's a big issue, especially in a bunch of his writings. I think if we're going to talk about Crowley and the problems with Crowley and who he was, we're going to get lost from what is potentially useful here. You know, we can look at Freud and say, well, look at Freud and his issues. And yet, Freud tells us things that are helpful. Freud set certain things in motion which were helpful. You know, we can look at many people, especially historical figures, and sort of glean levels of benefit from them without having to excuse them or deny that they were flawed in one way or another. And, you know, I'm not going to be the person who denies that Crowley had his flaws, because he had more than most people. So ultimately the question that anyone who is undecided based on that factor needs to kind of look at is, does the artwork in the deck speak for itself? Does Lady Frieda Harris's influence as the actual painter of this work mitigate the negative aspects of Crowley at all? And secondly, we can look at what other sources might we look to for meaning, you know, and James Wanless has written about this deck. Angeles Arian has written about it. You know, I mean, there are authors who get into this deck in other ways. You know, I'm not sure how true to the cohesion and the structure which I was speaking about today those authors are, even though their work is very profound and helpful. It really depends on what you're looking for here. So, those are the things that I have to say about this deck tonight. So, I'm going to be running this 8-week class starting on April 2nd. And this class is going to cover esoteric relationships to the Thoth deck without a stressful, horrible, strenuous having to learn everything about Kabbalah, having to wade through the oblique and densely written Book of Thoth itself, without having to grind your brain through the meat grinder in order to hope to kind of grasp all of this stuff. The problem with studying Kabbalah and studying astrology and alchemy and some of these other things in relationship to tarot is everybody wants you to become so invested in these things that you know everything about them. And the reality is that, you know, Pareto's rule apply, you know. You're going to use the first 20% of what you need, you know, what you learn about this 80% of the time. And when we go through this class, we're really going to cover what Crowley intended behind this, how it relates to, you know, to magical practices and other things, how it ties into Kabbalah, alchemy, you know, astrology and mythology, but in ways that is not caught up in jargon, in ways that are not difficult to understand, and in ways that are actually able to apply directly to a person's life, as opposed to sitting around and going, huh, so this card relates to their neshama. What does that mean in this situation? What is a person's neshama in relationship to their day job? You know, there are these questions that get lost in language. And, you know, one of the interpretations of that is we could say, okay, well, you know, if the neshama is one of those parts of ourselves that lives outside of time, that understands everything about us and who we are and where we're going, and it, you know, it sort of ties into this intuitive way of existing, you know, we could think of it as our intuitive mind. We could think of it as this sort of whispering from spirit that is unmanifest and eternal, yet close enough to actually be able to access and interact with us, you know? And so there are ways in which we can change our conception of these ideas from weird, hard to pronounce, abstract terms on a page into actual living tools to describe to a person in their life. And so we're going to talk about these things in very practical terms and very grounded terms. We're not going to spend huge amounts of time learning Hebrew or learning all sorts of different things about it. We're going to learn the structure and the references, and then we're going to spend a lot of time understanding how this helps inform the meaning of the cards and how that can help us add deeper and more profound levels to our meaning, to our readings. We're also going to get into exploring some of the relationships between the cards. There are many cards that are paired together as a either as an evolution or as a dialogue between two different points, and those pairings are profound in helping us understand both philosophically, I think, the nature of being alive, as well as you know, obviously understanding the deck itself. And we're going to go through card by card and talk about each of the cards and the symbolism and why it's there and what it means and how we might actually use that in readings to share with people. You know, so it's going to be very, very profound and deep on the one hand, but I don't want anybody to be scared because it's going to also be very accessible and practical and grounded at the same time. So the class starts April 2nd. It runs for 8 weeks. It is 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Eastern Standard Time in Toronto. The class is available through in-person participation as well as from online participation. And all of the classes will be recorded in case you can't make them all. You know, 8 consecutive Wednesdays is a difficult commitment sometimes, but they'll all be recorded for review later. If you are listening to this recording after the class, the whole course will be available for purchase later on. The cost is $280 plus tax if you're Canadian. If you're not, then there's no tax. And if you need to make an installments plan to make this happen for yourself, please do get in touch. Okay, I don't want anybody missing out because coming up with it all at once is a bit much. But paying it, you know, every other week over the run of the course or something is much more manageable. These things can be worked out. So finally, I want to give a shout out to Avril Price, who asked me a question, which was, what is with the baboon on the magician card? And on the one hand, I mean, there's a lot of complexity to the baboon or to the monkey or to the ape. And, you know, certainly one interpretation is that the ape represents the unconscious or unknown forces. The baboon is one of the manifestations of Thoth in his role as when he goes into the underworld, right? And remember that Thoth is the Egyptian god of magic, right? Most specifically, though, Crowley speaks of the ape of Thoth, or the cynocephalous ape. I'm probably butchering that. You know, it's the advantage of reading from books and not having people to converse with who still speak these languages. But the Ape of Thoth follows the magician around and distorts his truth. So that is that as much as the magician is always trying to be authentic and true, as much as we associate him with the ideas of mastery and profound magical speech as a clear transformative force moving into the world, immediately after he has spoken, the monkey distorts it and transforms it and tries to turn it into something else. And so in the magician, we have this sort of difference between the exalted either inner life or exalted removed from society spiritual life as perfection, as truth, as being utterly connected. And yet we have this sense that perfection is not to be found in the world, that illusion, that dishonesty, that distortion is always going to follow our attempts to be clear and precise. You know, and all we need to do is think about the game of broken telephone to realize how quickly that monkey can distort a truth that we say so clearly to our friends. By the time it gets back around to us, we won't even recognize it as the words we had uttered. So, thank you all for listening. This is going to be permanently available on thehermitslamp.com. And if you would like to check out more about the class, please go to thehermitslamp.com/events. Drop me an email, drop me a call, check in with me on Facebook, and you can certainly register online. I thank you for listening, and I'm looking forward to teaching. Talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.